Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum, where a podcast is dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. I am one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and I'm joined by Joe Dunn today, and we are in our podcast endeavors. So if you're a regular listener, you know this. If you're a brand new listener, you might not. We try to encourage and cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. We think that there is this awesome body of Protestant doctrine that can help answer a lot of the questions that we have today and give us robustness to our faith, but we don't have to become internet jerks about it. We can actually be interested in ideas and in concepts that are outside of our own tradition to learn and grow us and stretch us in different ways. So if you listen for any length of time, we talk to all sorts of people about all sorts of topics, and it really stretches us intellectually, pushes us to become more knowledgeable and to understand the best and most cutting edge arguments for whatever position it is, whether we disagree or agree or not. So in today's episode, I am thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. Gerald McKinney, whose work I have read and benefited from at length for a number of years. And he's worked a lot in moral theology. So we're going to be talking broadly about moral theology. In particular, we're going to focus a little bit on Karl Barth and his work on Barth's theological ethics. And we'll see if we have time for some biotechnological questions as well, because he also has a really nice book on that that I think maybe that was 2020 or 2021 or something that it came out. So, Jerry, maybe before we jump in, just give me a little bit of background. Where do you teach now? What was it? I'd be curious, what was the impetus to say, I want to study moral theology just to begin with, even at the beginning of your academic journey?
Well, first, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really happy to be part of this really important endeavor that you've been running here. I teach moral theology at the University of Notre Dame, where I've been for almost 24 years now. I first got into moral theology in a somewhat indirect way. I was a graduate student who ran out of stipend money and had to get a job, and I ended up as a patient advocate in a hospital emergency room. So I became first interested in bioethics, and that led me to broader interests in moral theology.
So as I think about moral theology just in general, I would guess that a number of Protestants, especially evangelicals today, probably have no idea what moral theology really means. I mean, you know what the term moral means, but like as an actual discipline of theology, that might not come to mind for them. So maybe could you just give me a little bit of understanding on what, just when we talk about moral theology, what are the main ideas and things that we're talking about?
You know, moral theology, first of all, is a term that is mostly used by Catholics and Anglicans. It is a term with a long history in those traditions. Protestants are usually likely to use the term theological ethics. And evangelicals, I think, might be more likely to just use the term Christian ethics. So these are all more or less the same thing. But they do have some nuances of difference. But I see moral theology as basically a branch of theology. So if we think of theology as I think Aquinas rightly thought of it, as relating everything to God. So it's the branch of theology that, I mean, it's a branch of human inquiry that relates everything to God. Then moral theology would just be relating our moral lives to God. And of course, it's an academic discipline, so we do that in an academically disciplined way, but that's basically what it is. So it's just, just another theological discipline alongside systematic theology, pastoral theology, historical theology, but its point is to relate the moral lives to God.
Okay, so that's helpful. So I guess, when I grew up, all I saw probably was ethics, and I don't think I ever saw the terminology of moral theology until midway through my academic career, probably after seminary. I don't think I'm being introduced to that terminology. So that makes sense. The contrast, it seems, then between moral theology and moral philosophy is just that moral theology is assuming that God exists, or is there more of a distinction between those two than just sort of like we're assuming Christianity or just theism is true?
Yeah, that's a good question. Moral philosophy, of course, is not as philosophy anyway, assuming the truth of Christian revelation. It's not assuming scripture. So One way to characterize the two is that moral theology works with a source that moral philosophy doesn't have. Moral philosophy approaches ethics, we could say, through reason, through rational inquiry. And of course, I think from a theological perspective as well, morality is rational, but it's also more than that because we're related to, if we relate everything to God, God, I think, can be known in part and very dimly through reason, but God is best known and mostly known through revelation. So if we're going to relate things to God, we need revelation, and philosophy isn't necessarily going to follow us there. So I think that's a big difference. In practice, what that means is that a lot of moral theology is really concerned with scripture. What does the Bible tell us about our moral life, and what does the Christian tradition tell us about our moral life? So those are the differences. And I don't look at it as moral theology rejecting the approach to moral questions through reason, but putting those in a broader context, in a much more ultimately final context of our lives with God. And I think of we can look at scripture not as just telling us only what's entirely new to revelation, but as giving us a clearer idea than we would have had of what reason would have come up with if we weren't fallen.
Earlier, you had mentioned that Anglicans and Catholics use the phrase moral theology in a way that Protestants don't. You said something like Christian ethics or theological ethics. Protestants, I know in my circles, will probably use that language more than moral theology. So, just sort of a follow-up on that then. So, why do you think Protestants haven't focused on moral theology as a discipline to the extent that, say, Roman Catholics have? Maybe just talk about the intersection, the differences. This is a lingering question that I have as to why, Protestants are kind of late to the game, it seems, on some of these issues, especially in bioethics. We could talk about that later, of course, some of your biotech work. But it seems like Protestants are playing a lot of catch up on this to on these topics. So if you could just speak to that, that'd be great.
Yes, there are a couple of questions, two very good questions there. One is simply the terminological question, and I'm not quite sure why that has been the case. Early on, and there was the use of the term Christian ethics was in Protestant ethics early on. I'm not sure when or when it first appears in Catholic moral theology. So in some ways, it goes way back. Theological ethics was the term used through the 19th century in German Protestant theology. Schleiermacher also used the term Christian ethics. Christian ethics, I think, was usually the term used by the social gospel movement in the United States, which had a lot of influence on later on the field later on. So I'm not sure there's any real interesting story to tell about those differences. They just seem to be historical, sort of contingent historical differences. Your other question was a question about Protestants catching up. I think it probably depends on what phase of history we take as our sort of starting point. The one advantage, I suppose, that you could say Catholics had is that they had a confessional practice that demanded being very explicit about what kinds of moral requirements we are under, and Protestants didn't really have something like that. So there was a kind of a tradition, long tradition of Catholics reflecting on what sins were such that required penance and what didn't, and what penance they required. So they had a whole history of discussion of questions that Protestants just didn't have that context to discuss. It is interesting that both Protestants and Catholics in the late 19th century began to think about ethics in terms of the social issues connected with industrialization. So you have Catholic social teachings emerging during that time, and also I mentioned the social gospel that emerged in Protestant thought. So you have, I think, since that time, both traditions doing a lot of thinking about what the requirements of our social lives are for our faith. Just in terms of of kinds of hot button issues in today's society, I think what we really have is a d certain difference, structural differences between the Catholic Church and Protestant evangelical churches. The Catholic Church, you have a long body of a long-term body of social teaching that's more or less consistent and continuous. You don't have anything like that in any Protestant church. So Protestants always seem like they're inventing the wheel on these issues because, in a sense, they are. Catholics, you have a teaching authority, the Pope and bishops, who make pronouncements on things and they get public attention. Protestants, it's not, I've heard people say it's not so much that Protestants don't have authorities, it's just that nobody really knows quite who they are. The media don't know who to go to, for example. So you have a more public discussion of ethics in Catholic circles, I think, for those reasons. I think if you look by contrast, I move from the public realm to just the academic realm, I think there probably is just as much attention to ethics among Catholics as Protestants in the academy. But I think it is different in the public realm, and I think it's for the reasons that I've mentioned. That's at least my initial thought.
Yeah, that makes sense. Even though, like, over the last 10 to 15 years, it seems like there has been a little bit of a shift toward more interest in this among Protestants. And I don't know how much of that is caused by just influential work by those like Oliver O'Donovan and those going and studying with him, and then sort of popularizing that for other Protestant contexts. That seems relevant, at least from my vantage point. I don't know, Joe, would you agree with that or no?
Yeah, I mean, as far as, having a few key Protestant figures, I think that's right. But your point about Jerry, your point about kind of the consolidation of authority or like a public-facing institution that the go-to, well, the Pope and the bishops and there's an obvious structure, there's an obvious institution that is turned that we can turn to find, the answers, right? In Catholicism, speaking generically here, but Protestantism, it's where do we go? Where do we go? Do we just look at, O'Donovan or this professor or that professor? Do we go to this seminary president, that seminary president? There's a bit of a more disjointed public-facing situation with Protestantism. Yeah,
Now,
super
Jerry,
fascinating.
this, I don't know if you tell me this is too personal, then that's fine. But I'm just curious. I mean, you've been at Notre Dame for what, 20 plus years or something like that, and you're a Protestant. Why did you not become Roman Catholic?
Yeah, that's a question I ask myself often. In fact, almost every day. But I used to joke with people that I'm probably I was hired here to teach Protestant moral theology. So I joke with people that if I'm probably the only person at Notre Dame, the only employee of Notre Dame who would lose his job if he converted to Catholicism. But of course, that's not quite true. But well, I think I mean, there are lots of reasons why one might stay in the tradition one has, and for me, a lot of, there are a few things that would be, I suppose, barriers to joining the Roman Catholic Church. They're very few, and they're not, some people wouldn't necessarily consider them deal breakers, but I think when you convert to a tradition, you pretty much have to endorse it wholeheartedly and fully. And I have the highest regard for it, and even I can say a kind of love for that the church, Catholic Church, and its tradition. But I don't know if I could go in wholeheartedly. So that's one major reason. But another reason is, I think this is maybe a more professional reason. I think there are a lot of untapped resources in Protestant thought, Protestant moral theology that are oftentimes brought to the surface by conversations with Catholic moral theology. I'm thinking about what Protestants have done in recent years with natural law and virtue. But I think there's still a lot of work to be done on Protestant sources on issues that are of common concern with Catholics. And I think it's good to have Protestants in Catholic settings and vice versa, working together on those issues.
Yeah, I would. Your comment about Protestants in recent years picking up the ball here on natural law and virtue ethics, things like that. That's been a really welcomed development, I think. Something that I think was in the background of my comment earlier about Protestants are a little late to the game, or are just kind of late to have some of these conversations that have been had before in history. But maybe you could highlight a few of these other areas, because natural law being one of them. I've got a book here on my desk right now about the Aristotelian tradition and early modern Protestantism. It's just some of those things are just forgotten. So beyond virtue ethics, beyond natural law, what are some of these other areas that you see there being fruitful discourse for Protestants, Catholics in the broader moral theological tradition?
Yes. Well, first, I think it is important to underscore the point you just mentioned, which is that there are a lot of Protestants who are recovering a kind of Aristotelian Thomist strand, especially in 17th century Protestantism, but even going back into the 16th century. And I think that's important work, and work that has really changed our understanding of what Protestant ethics is all about. One question I suppose one could raise about that, it is really interesting that a lot of these Protestant thinkers were Thomists. The question is it interesting the sort of Thomists that they were? Or in other words, can we say, hey, these people were doing the Thomist thing too, or do they have anything to contribute that's different from that? And I think that's a question that is still to be determined. I'm not quite sure what the answer to that is. But I also think there are strands in earlier Protestant thought that have to do with natural law and virtue and aren't necessarily Thomistic or exclusively Thomistic. I mean, Calvin and Melanchthon had, and others, a lot of other earlier 16th century Protestant thinkers, Zanchi and others, had notions of natural law, and what we can talk about whether they how Thomistic they were. Even with Hooker, we can talk about how Thomistic he was, but maybe the real question is not how Thomistic they were, but what they had to say on their own as the theologians they were. So I think even with the turn to natural law, there's still a lot of interesting work to be done. If you go outside natural law and virtue, there are lots of issues that Catholics and Protestants are all dealing with in our contemporary society. We're all dealing with democracy, for example, and the political order. We're dealing with issues of sexuality. We're dealing with other issues of social justice, economic justice, racial justice, and these sorts of things. I think the maybe a frustration to me is that both Catholics and Protestants, at least in the United States, and I think in other places as well, but certainly in the United States, basically just break down along the familiar right-left lines. And one would have hoped that both Catholics and Protestants would find ways to complicate those dichotomies. And somehow we haven't been able to do that, or not consistently. So I think there are moral theologians who do that to a greater or lesser degree. But I think that is a those sorts of issues that we're all facing today are issues on which I think there's not what interests me is not so much a Protestant Catholic distinction. I don't think there's much of a difference there, but the difference is in both communities between the two poles in our society.
Yeah, so I did want to spend a little bit of time trying to talk about Karl Barth and his own moral thought, because you have two books on this: The Analogy of Grace, Karl Barth's Moral Theology, and then the more recent Karl Barth's Moral Thought. And I'm just interested. I mean, when it comes to Karl Barth, I mean, what are the main facets of his own theological ethics? Is there anything that's really unique or different about him compared to, let's say, just a traditional Roman Catholic teaching, or what I would imagine most Protestants today in the 21st century are probably more accustomed to?
Yes, well, Barth is probably most distinguished by his determination to see everything in relation to Christ. Now, I say that one colleague here recently retired who is a scholar of Thomas Aquinas, who thought the third part of the Summa, which is on Christology, was actually the key to the whole Summa. So Aquinas too sees everything in relation to Christ, but you might say that Barth does it up front and in your face. Aquinas lets you get through, the rest of the Summa before you face the Christology. But so everything is Christological for Barth, in the sense that what Christ does is act in our place. That's his basically his Reformation era conception of grace. But not only as sinners who can't act for ourselves, which was the more classic Reformation position, but also Christ acts in our place as creatures. And in fact, Christ is even the elect one. So he's even the one who acts in our place as the one God elects from eternity. So all of this means there's a strong emphasis on grace in Barth's theology. But what Barth's maybe his most brilliant theological move was the way that he was able to say, well, Christ doesn't just act for us or in our place. He involves us in what he does for us. So you could maybe put it this way: he calls us to act as those for whom he has acted. So the technical terms here are gospel and law, familiar Reformation era terms. Barth reverses them: gospel first, law second. So God acts for us, that's the gospel, and he commands us to live our lives as people for whom he's acted, so that's law. And his ethics, really, all the intricacies, all the elaborations, they're all about how we do that, how we act as those for whom Christ has acted in our lives as creatures, in our lives as reconciled sinners, and ultimately as those who are destined for redemption. So I think that's the main theme of Barth's ethics, and I think everything he does is a variation on that theme.
So you've spent a good deal of time with Barth over the last, I don't know how many years you've been really engaging him, but I have seen, like, at least from my vision, it seems like Barth has lost a little bit of his luster recently. Do you think that's warranted? Do you think his contributions to these discussions are still really valuable? Or are there sort of cracks in the foundation that you think these should be highlighted, and there are other resources that we should be similarly engaging or otherwise? Like, I think of a theologian, I can't remember who it was, who said something like he called Barth like he who must not be named. And I get some of the, the moral challenges and questions that have come with his own personal life.
Yes.
And like very much like I feel conflicted about anyone who has significant moral failings and is writing on theology. It doesn't matter who it is, what it is, but irrespective of that, just the actual writing themselves is what I'm most interested in.
Yeah, that is an important point. That's one factor in what I agree with you is a kind of situation we're in now, where I think you can say Barth is on the downslope rather than the upslope. One way in which people are continuing to engage him is not so much in his theological claims, but in his in his kind of political and social interventions and things like this, and analogies to our own times. I'm not sure how far that's going to go or how long that's going to go, but I think that his permanent contribution, if there is one, would really be his insistence that Christ is the norm of human action. And I think that really is a significant move. I mean, we can think of Christ in terms of the grace that enables us to act morally. That's what Aquinas did. We can think of him as an example who shows us that human beings can actually live morally, which is what Kant did. We can think of him as establishing a kind of concrete Christian form of ethical life with Schleiermacher. But there's something to be said for all those options. But Bard really says, in addition to all those things, Christ really is the norm of human action. And I think that's right. I think any ethic that is Christian is going to have to say that. And Bard, of course, said it very loud, very loudly, and very consistently.
Could you comment too, just on another aspect of Barthes' thinking, his relationship or his ideas about natural law, the relationship between that Christ-focused approach to ethics or Christ-centered approach to ethics, where natural law fits into that? I know we talked about natural law earlier, so if you could comment on that, elaborate on that, that'd be great.
Yeah, Bart, of course, was an opponent of natural theology. It should follow that he opposed natural law, but he actually had a nuanced relationship with that whole question. And basically, I think what you can say is that for him, moral philosophy is a kind of natural law because for him, reason says implicitly what revelation in Christ says explicitly. So, reason gives us, so the Word of God poses us to us, who is Christ, poses to us the question of whether our conduct conforms to Christ. This notion of a moral, a moral truth posing to human beings the moral question of their existence. The question of the rightness or goodness of their conduct, Bart thought that's what moral philosophy does in a kind of formal way, and Revelation does it in a kind of material way. So you can say, in a sense, that he and Bart thought that theological ethics had to engage in a continuous conversation with that philosophical question. So you could say, in a sense, that he's that revelation is recognizing reason in that sense. He even says that moral philosophy gives us all the content of of Christian ethics, theological ethics, but it doesn't give it to us in an explicit Christological way. So you could say, in a sense, that if natural law is doing implicitly what moral theology is doing, then it's or sorry, if philosophy, moral philosophy is doing implicitly what moral theology is doing, then it's kind of natural law. But I think there are real problems with that position because it means that Christians have explicit access to something that other people have implicitly. There's something to be said for that, but it also there's a lot to be said for that, really. But it also creates, I think, a lot of problems. So I don't think Bard is a very helpful person to aid Protestants in the recovery of natural law.
Interesting. Now, I do want to spend a couple of minutes as well of what we have left talking about your work on biotechnology, just because I think that topic is super important. And I've got Joe with me who he can nerd out about this because he's done his homework. So I'm going to ask one question and then I'm going to let him sort of roll with any additional ones. But I really, really liked your book on biotechnology and sort of cashing out the various frameworks that were out there. And so maybe we just start with, I mean, when we talk about human biological nature, is there and can there be a normative status attached to that? And if so, what is it?
Yes. In my view, there has to be some normative significance for biological nature just because it's part of the human nature created by God. It's part of the human nature that Christ assumed in becoming incarnate. So I think for those reasons, it has to have some normative significance. So what significance does it have? Well, one thing I think that always has to be kept in mind is, like all of biological nature, human nature is not static. Human biological nature isn't static or fixed. So if you think that its normative status is such that it requires you not to do anything at all to change it, I think that's a mistake, just because I think biological nature itself is static. To put it in a or not static, it's always changing. So to put it in another way, I mean, just look at how biological characteristics like human height, for human stature, for example, have changed the light, human life expectancy. You could argue about whether those are changes in human biological nature. Well, it just the way literacy changes brain functions, or the way spending too much time on social media to, alters brain functions. We're always changing our nature, and it would seem to be odd that we can't introduce changes into nature intentionally. That our nature is constantly changing, and there's a complete prohibition of changing it intentionally. So I think that's one position that I think we could rule out. On the other hand, there are some people who appeal to the notion that our nature is constantly changing to then say that, well, that means it's simply open to us to do as we please with it. And I think that just treats our biological nature as raw material for whatever our wants and wishes happen to be. And I think that just doesn't respect it as something that, for all that has gone through to get to the stage that it is now, all the changes it's undergone, that somehow there isn't something about it that is good and as it is, and something that should be respected. So I think it's pretty easy, I think, on theological grounds, to rule out those two alternatives. The harder question is what the question I think that really the ethical work concerns, and that's so our biological nature is a sort of, you could call it a substratum or something, a base, a condition for all the human goods that we pursue. There's nothing that we do that doesn't involve our biological nature. The highest flights of mystical contemplation involve neurons, you know. So the question is, what kinds of goods does our biological nature serve? Our interventions into them can presumably promote or hinder those goods. They can further them or inhibit them. And that, to me, is the question that the ethics of biotechnology has to ask.
Yeah, so in your book, you obviously lay out a handful of these accounts. And the first account that you had mentioned, where human nature is sort of fixed, I was wondering if we could maybe make a distinction between accidental properties, something roughly like accidental versus essential properties. I think in your book you labeled it the Augustinian view, if I'm not mistaken, represented by folks like O'Donovan, Lewis, and some others. So, could we make a distinction like that to track some of these questions where, sure, biotechnology can make some changes to accidental properties or things like height, eye color, I don't know, do some gene editing, use some CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing techniques to make sure none of us get these really bad diseases without fundamentally changing our nature? Can we see nature as a sort of set of broader bumpers that within which we could operate without totally overriding the nature, the essential nature? Is that something we could maybe think about? Can we think of
Yes,
it that way, in other words?
I think that's a helpful way of putting it. The way you put it, I think, very well. The way maybe I would put it, to say the exact same thing, is you can introduce a lot of changes without changing the kind of thing that something is. And kinds are not fixed. And So I think the answer to that is unquestionably yes. And that's I think Oliver O'Donovan, in his most recent book, I think objected to my characterization of his position there. I don't think I hope I didn't attribute him to him the notion that nature is static, because he doesn't hold that position, and he's wonderfully clear in his most recent book of what his position is. But there are people who do think that human nature, any change, any changes to human nature by biotechnology are illicit because they're not maybe because they're changing a kind. I don't think they think in those terms, but because they're intervening into something that should be protected from our intervention. And so I think you're right that the and I think Augustine, you can understand Augustine in those ways of saying that God creates kinds and there's diversity within kinds. I think you could certainly understand O'Donovan that way, and I think that is to say that we can intervene into those accidental qualities is very different from a position that holds that that we shouldn't intervene because there's something ab about the human intervention that it inevitably involves control, manipulation, in effect, doing violence to nature. And nature is the condition of personhood. So to intervene into nature is to intervene into someone's personhood. I think that's more of a position that's of, say, Jürgen Habermas. It's a position that I think some of C.S. Lewis's writings suggest. And I think that's different from the Aristotelian, Augustinian, Thomistic one that you just set out.
So, I mean, tell me, like, when I think about these questions, they're very difficult. And I'm like, in some senses, it seems like it would be easier just to simply say, don't touch anything. But then you get all these other questions that are like, well, if this person's like hurting and I can somehow, or there is potential for them to have pain, wouldn't I want to preemptively prevent that from happening? And as I think about how do I have a structured framework for this, I have no idea what to do. So maybe, I mean, in your preferred like approach, how do you handle these questions yourself?
Yes, I think we have to handle these questions in a variety of ways. And maybe I can just put it in terms of the different approaches to interventions, enhancement interventions, which I think we're talking about here, biological enhancement interventions. And one approach is just to put ethical safeguards around what we do. So whatever we do it safely. We do it in a way that's fair to everyone. We respect people's free choices. And that to all of those ethical values, I think are values that moral theologians should hold. I don't think moral theologians think we should do things in a harmful way or an unfair way or just run roughshod over people's rational autonomy. So I think that's part of the picture and a necessary part of the picture. There is another approach that maybe we could call, say is more critical. It interrogates the ideals of what kinds of about what kinds of physical or cognitive or moral characteristics we are hoping to bring about by our enhancements, by intervening into our biological nature. So do those ideals, physical, cognitive, and moral ideals, do they reflect problematic social values? Do they reflect, say, problematic commitments to, making everybody as maximally productive as possible, just like our institutions do? Do they, are there racial biases, cultural biases, and so on that that they are expressing when they intervene. So that's a second question I think is really important to ask. I mean, we have you can I think any society is going to have somewhat distorted understandings of what what traits are valuable. We to just look at the way what we focus on cognitive traits, for example, and what that does to people with intellectual disabilities in our society, just to take one example. So and we want everyone to be we want cognitive traits that make everybody maximally rational and productive. Well, those may not be the only or the highest uses of our cognitive capacity. So you get the point there. And then the third one would be the we've already sort of moved into it, the position that inquires into what goods are we're trying to instantiate in these interventions and whether we're inhibiting what's truly a human good or promoting it. So I think all three of those approaches need to be undertaken.
Joe, do you have any final question on this topic?
Yeah, I was just thinking, I had two sort of lingering questions, but and feel so feel free to take whichever one up you'd like and take a swing. One of my first questions was about even if we afford a normative status to human nature, one of the points of your book was that it's not an absolute normativity, it's an absolute status, and so it seems defeasible. We might factor the normativity of of human nature into the equation when we're considering enhancements and things like that. But if it's defeasible, if nature, if the normative status of our nature is defeasible, I'm just worried about overriding considerations where it's like, yeah, human nature is such and it's valuable and so on, but dot dot dot, and whatever comes after the but there, is always going to be an open question. But I guess my second question, again, feel free to take these up as you please. I know we're sort of low on time, but it has to do with the relationship between messing around with human nature and Christology. So, obviously Christ came to die for us humans and took on our nature. And so, I know that this was, I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, this may have been a question you were addressing in your appendix of the book. About post-humanism, whether it's possible for just rational animals, and then what the relationship between post-humanism and Christology would be, could be, some interesting lingering questions there. So I'll throw those out there. You feel free to swing at any of those as you find interesting, and we'll go from there.
Thank you. I'll be very they're both questions that deserve a lot more attention than I'm going to give them, but I'll give them both quick answers. The first one, there are things in Christian ethics and Christian life and moral theology that are wrong at all times and in all places, and those are not overridable in my view or defeasible. I don't think interventions into biological nature are among those that class of acts. So in other words, they're not always and in all circumstances wrong. So that was simply what I wanted to point out there. So, there may the question is what could defeat that claim and those are or that status I mean and those are difficult questions. That I don't have time to get into here, but the last one is an important one. I think Christ, in becoming incarnate in human beings, joined the entire cosmos to himself and through human beings. That's, I think, what the term "all things" in Christ reconciling all things in Scripture. Means that it's he's not just redeeming the world, he's redeeming the entire cosmos, but he's also doing it in a human nature. So the cosmos is bizarre as it may seem to people when we think in terms of astronomy, the whole cosmos is being redeemed through Christ through his human nature. And that gives, I think, human nature a kind of position that would be such that the aspiration to become something other than human is an aspiration to be related to Christ in a less direct way. And so I That's my way of ruling out some sorts of transhumanist visions on those grounds.
That's super interesting. Well, Jerry, this has been a lot of fun. I feel like we could probably talk for another hour or two about a lot of these topics. So maybe for our listeners who want to follow up with more of your work or more resources, is the best place to go like your faculty page on Notre Dame, or is there another, do you have a website or anything?
Yeah, probably the faculty page at Notre Dame.
Okay, cool. Well, I encourage you all to do that. What I'll do to make sure, I'll link to some of these books that we've discussed in the show notes. So wherever you're listening, if it's on your phone or on your computer or whatever, if you look in the description of the show notes, you'll see links to each of these books. So you just click the link, it'll take you there so you can go get a copy of it and learn more for yourself. I always encourage people to read widely, but also to support authors who are doing critical, important, interesting work. So it's the amount of hours and time that people put into producing high quality resources like this is incredible. They're not getting paid anything near what the actual labor is to create these things. So go ahead and purchase it, support them in those ways. And then, Jerry, we look forward to the future projects that you have in due course. And we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us here on what we call the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And so we'll talk to you all soon.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.